Good evening. My name's Rachel. I am an alcoholic. Thank you, Scotty. So, I was thinking today, you know, I'm sure that it's not news to anybody that it's the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and I've been reflecting on that. And when the plane hit the first tower, I was at work. I worked for a doctor. And he asked me if I wanted to go home, and I said, no, that's okay. But when the plane hit the second tower, I was like, I want to go home. Oh, by the way, I'm from North Garden, not Charlottesville. Important distinction. So I left where I was working in North Garden and went home, but then I went the Tuesday noon AA meeting at Jefferson Park Avenue in Charlottesville. And I led the meeting. And I said, I'm not going to pretend this is a regular day. And I could tell by the blank looks on some of the people, they didn't know what I was talking about, so I explained what had happened. And we had an AA meeting. And I thought about the people in the Twin Towers that were recovering alcoholics, and that I'm sure that there were meetings in the towers, probably noon meetings, you know. So I just want to remember that and just thank God for the lives that we have today, and thank God for the lives that went before us. And, so my sobriety date is September 21st, 1988, and my home group is the Hilltop Group in North Garden, Virginia. We meet at Thursday nights at 6 p.m. We're an open discussion meeting except for the second Thursday of the month, which we call second speaker, and we have a speaker. And we, like you guys, we alternate male, female, so so come see us sometime. We'll be having our fifth anniversary meeting in the second Thursday in November. And we have chili and a speaker. So put that on your calendar. Come on down. We had 60 people for our anniversary meeting last year, and normally we had like 5 people at the meeting. So it was very successful. Yeah. And now we've built up to, we actually have 7 home group members, which is stunning. So it's a growing meeting. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't know. I like hearing people's background stories. You know, I was born in Canada. My father was a minister. My mom was a housewife. I have 3 sisters and a brother. I'm the second youngest. I had a good childhood. And there was no alcohol in our family, drinking. That was part of our religion, that you didn't drink, you didn't smoke, you didn't dance. You didn't But, you know, church was obviously, my dad was a minister. Church was our life. Everything about my life was, you know, Sunday morning going to, what do they call that? Church school, and then the sermon, and then we actually had a Sunday evening service, and we had a Wednesday night prayer service, and Thursday night choir practice, and Friday night youth group, and Saturday morning was girls group, and then you have school, you know, and that was our life. Something that was very wonderful about that was, though, my dad, they had a lot of camps in the summer, and so we would go to camps up in northern Ontario, and then when we moved to the States, all up and down the East Coast. So that was one of the things I really loved about my childhood. I was pretty sheltered, and we moved to New Jersey when I was 14 years old. Totally broke my heart. I was a very happy Canadian. and if some of you may not know the dirty little secret about Canadians, is that they can have a bias against Americans. And I did not want to move to this place, in this country. And my dad sat me down and he said, there are good people in the United States too. I mean, those were his words. There are good people in the United States. And I have found that to be true. Yeah. So moving to New Jersey, however, was a turning point in my life and very difficult. I did not fit in. I lived in a rural city in Canada where I could go anywhere. You know, if you had a dime, you get on the bus and you know, I felt very safe. And we moved to Ridgewood, New Jersey, which is right outside of New York City. It also has one of the highest income levels in the country. And we had the parish house next to the church. And, we had debutantes. You know, I mean, and we were making our own clothes. And it was just really, really different. And I can't say that I really had any friendships that have lasted. Again, we had our church family. That was wonderful. But I was pretty depressed during that time. I graduated when I was almost seven. Well, how old was I? I was 17. I graduated. My birthday was June 10th, and I turned 17 and graduated like a week later. So I was very young. And my dad had gotten a job for me up in Binghamton, New York, and I went there and worked the summer, lived with a church family, and I left directly from there to college. The thing that I had never been encouraged in my life was to really have any independence. I was very dependent, dependent on my family and my sisters, being the second youngest. And my brother was the oldest and brilliant and special and was given lots of opportunities. And my oldest sister was very a leader, a natural leader. And then there were like the three younger girls, and we were just always the three younger girls. So I didn't choose my college. My parents chose my college. I went to Graceland. It's now Graceland University in Lamona, Iowa, which was the church school. And in high school, so the time frame here is I graduated in 1972. And, you know, I was exposed to marijuana in high school. I had a couple of boyfriends, and they smoked a little pot. But I was just so, like, at home, so sort of fearful of what my parents would think or do or whatever, that kept me from doing anything. And so when I got out to this college in the heart of cattle country, which the banner in the middle of the street said when you drove into this Lamona, Iowa, 1,500 people, 1,500 students, and I actually liked it because I liked being back in the country. And I went to a party my very first night, and this guy offered me to smoke some pot, and I did. And I know, you know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, but I have to tell my whole story. And I wasn't going to drink. Drinking held no appeal to me. And I was with the artistic people, and they were the druggies, and the jocks were the drinkers, and I was a writer, and you know, then I just, you know, I got a roommate who liked to do the same things that I liked to do. But in January, I had a date with this guy who was a hockey player, Canadian. His name was Bongo. And he always said, you know, if you just put Bongo in the zip code, the mail would get to him, and it did. I mean, at that time, that's all you needed. Yeah. And I was really enjoying the date with him, and he was a drinker. And so I had my first drink, which was Boone's Farm apple wine. And we split a bottle of wine, and I just thought it was excellent. You know, everything changed for me. I'm still am an introvert, but I was very shy and introverted, and having grown up with, you know, not really having to do anything for myself, my sisters or my brother or my mother, you know, people would do things for me. So it enabled me to flirt with him, talk to other people, you know, just laugh and have fun and just relax. And what I didn't know is, I didn't know this at all. I didn't know that my grandfather was an alcoholic. I didn't know that my uncle and aunt were alcoholics. Of course, I had no idea of knowing that in the future my children would be alcoholics, you know. But what happened is that once I had that first drink, I just wanted to drink more. And I didn't even try to control it. In Lamoni, there was one bar. I was calling it Gracie's. It used to be Gracie's, but it was Bob's Place by the time I got there. And you could buy, they only sold beer, only had a beer bar. And you could buy a draft for a quarter. And that was even cheap back then. So, and I hardly ever stayed on campus. I was always sleeping over at somebody's house in town. And you had to walk by that bar to get to campus. And it was just like, I just couldn't walk by the bar. Now, I'm still 17, you know, and the age was 18. But they assumed, because I was a freshman, that I was probably 18. And that went on for a few weeks, and until the bartender went on campus and looked up everybody's ages. So they could do that back then. And it's like, oh, you can't drink here. But, you know, it's a typical thing. I drank until I passed out or there wasn't any more available or I puked or, you know, or I didn't have any money or just whatever. And I remember being able to drink a lot. Now, the first time I drank liquor, I drank tequila, and I blacked out. So my solution to that was I just didn't drink tequila. Yeah, and it seemed like every time I drank hard liquor, I'd black out. I didn't know how to, I just drank it too fast. I just couldn't, so I was primarily a beer and a wine drinker. So from January of 1973 and until August of that year, I just drank. And I got very depressed very quickly and suicidal. And I ideated suicide a lot, and then I attempted suicide. And my oldest sister, by the way, my sisters all went to the same school. And my oldest sister was married and living with her husband off campus. And I went to her and I told her that I had tried to kill myself. I had not called the doctor. The man I was with had called the doctor and he said, tell her she's crazy. And that was real helpful. But, you know, now I don't know. I don't know if he actually called, you know, or if he just said that, you know. So, you know, I tried to kill myself by, I was drinking beer and I just started taking aspirin. And I took about half a bottle of aspirin, which can really mess up your hearing. and I know I'm not the only one that's done that, because when I tell my story, there's usually somebody comes up and says that they did that. But I couldn't find, you know, I'd been hanging around with all these people that were druggies, and, you know, I'd had my little Quaalude binge, and I guess it just the grace of God that the night that I really wanted to kill myself, I couldn't find the pills that would do it. But I also knew that I was pregnant, and the man I was pregnant with was married. He was like 26, and he was married to a woman that I worked with. I was on my campus job, and I'd worked with his mother. And, you know, I just couldn't face the reality of having to tell my parents what was going on. So they did find out eventually, but I did have an abortion. And the drinking, the pregnancy is a consequence of my drinking. You know, I had birth control. I knew about birth control. And I was too drunk, you know, to take care of myself. So And he was a drunk. Well, I don't know. I just know that every time I tried to talk to him, he was drunk. And I eventually went to his father, and his father gave me the money to get an abortion. And that's kind of like another story. But and I when I returned from that, I had to go to Kansas. That I was severely depressed, and I and they'd given me I got an infection, and they and that's when I had to tell my parents. So I had to go to the hospital, and they gave me Darvon for pain, and I kind of got addicted to that. So, in the meantime, I am a college student, you know? That's the whole thing. I'm a college student, and I'm not going to classes. And my first semester, I signed up for, like, I'm all gung-ho, man. I'm signed up for, like, 18 hours of classes, even though my advisor said, you know, maybe first semester, you know, try 15, you know? And I said, you know, I'm 18. And I completed 15 hours, which is pretty good. The next semester, I completed 12, and the next semester, I completed 9. And then the dean called me in and suggested maybe school wasn't really where my heart was at the moment. And so I left school, and I became a car hop at A&W Root Beer. But, you know, I felt better about myself because one of the things after the suicide attempt was that because I'd really prostituted myself for drugs and alcohol, and I was going to change that. I was going to be self-supporting as far as my drugs and alcohol went. And so that gave me a little bit of self-esteem. And I did feel better about myself and working. And then at one of those summer camps that I went to with my parents in New Hope, Pennsylvania, I met a guy, really nice guy. He was a few years older than I was. And we started correspondence. No, he had a little bit of a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. He came to my high school graduation, and we wrote. And then once I started drinking, I just cut that off. And I got back in touch with him. And he lived in Maryland, Rockville, Maryland. And actually, at the time, though, he was a student at University of New Mexico. And he came from New Mexico. And I had moved to Kansas City, where my parents had moved. And he lived with us. And my parents' ideal for us, for the girls, was to find the right man. And you'd be the helpmate for the man. So that's what I was raised with. So my husband, my future husband, was living in their basement as well as my sister's future husband. So we could be working, they could be working, and we could have, you know, we could be boyfriend, girlfriend, and it all seems very strange to me. But and then Danny decided to move home because he couldn't find work that he felt good about in Kansas City. So he moved to Maryland, and I followed soon after. And then I lived with his parents. And then we moved out together when I was 19, and we moved into an apartment together. So what happened then was that I dipped into the cocaine world for about a year and a half. I was living with Danny, and I was running around with this drug dealer and who I worked with. He was a very interesting man. He would put on his three-piece suit and go down to Capitol Hill and sell cocaine. And he carried a gun, and I loved him because he had cocaine. But my husband called me on the relationship. My boyfriend, Danny, called me on the relationship. And my husband worked the night shift. My boyfriend at the time worked the night shift. And I worked the day shift and with this guy. So often he would spend the night. And you know, it was just messy. It was real messy. And he called me on the relationship. And I, being who I was at the time, I couldn't see any way of supporting myself. So I felt like the only choice I had was I stay with Danny or I go with this guy. And I decided to, I thought it was wiser for me to stay with Danny. And I was so glad I made that decision. Because I think I would be dead if I'd gone the other way. So and then also the solution was for us to get married. That would solve everything. So we got married. And that was in 1977. Soon after that, I got pregnant, and which was planned. That was planned, my first pregnancy. And we moved to Charlottesville. Dan was able to transfer in his job as a postal clerk to Charlottesville. And I feel very happy to wake up when I got out of my long nightmare of drinking, that I woke up in Charlottesville, or North Garden, actually. Yeah. I didn't know anything. I was so ignorant, and I was so stoned and drunk that I didn't know, you know, and I was Canadian. I didn't understand the collegiate system, and I'd been so protected or cloistered by my family. And the educational system is quite different in Canada. And I didn't understand the University of Virginia. I was like, I thought I'd be able to come down here and just take a class here and there and get my degree. I didn't realize that you had to be, like, at the time, a full-time student to take classes. I mean, it was just not how I understand education. So anyway, we moved we lived a year in Charlottesville. We found our home in North Garden. I didn't drink at all during my pregnancy, but as soon as that first child was born, and my mother stayed for 2 weeks, as soon as she had left, I was like at the apartment upstairs, drinking beer, taking bong hits. And I'm really grateful to my husband, who's not an alcoholic, because there were times when I was unable to take care of the baby, and I would just even hear the baby cry, and he would take care of the baby. So we moved to Charlottesville, and in a way, I wanted it to be geographical. I wanted my life to change. I was going to stop smoking pot. I was going to stop drinking. I never felt good about it, ever. I never felt good about it. I always felt guilty about my drug use and my alcohol use because of my upbringing. You know, it was a sin to drink. So we got to Charlottesville, and I got involved with a yoga class and a spiritual group, and they did help me. However, at the yoga group, this woman had a child about the same age, and I was trying to make friends, and I invited her over for lunch. And as soon as we got inside, at that time I was living in Four Seasons apartments, she said, "Do you smoke pot?" And my heart just sank, because it's like, I didn't want to, and of course I said yes. And so then I had a connection right away. Geez. So, and I never stopped drinking. But then I got involved with a spiritual group. It's a Sufi group, and this little teeny group down in Thaber. And the only rule they had was not to use psychedelic drugs, so which they included marijuana in. And so I stopped. So I've been a daily pot smoker, I figured, for about 7 years, and I stopped smoking pot. So that was positive. And people weren't really drinking, so I thought that was part of it. And for me, like, spirituality and drinking were always tied together, and they actually are. So I had this period of sobriety where I was involved in, I learned how to meditate. I went on, went to some camps and things, and was pretty happy. And that's when my second child was conceived. And, but after he was born, you know, I feel really good about that period of my life and his birth. And, but after he was born, I got depressed, and it was probably, you know, postpartum depression. And my spiritual teacher suggested that my husband and I, we need to get a babysitter and go out and have a glass of wine. And I, you know, I remember that. And I just like that little devil on one shoulder and angel on the other. And the angel was saying, don't tell me that. And the devil was saying, all right, permission. So we went out and had a glass of wine, had several glasses of wine. And as usually happened, my Danny would have to stop several times so I would throw up on the way home. And I was just kind of off to the races again. So my third child was conceived again when I was drunk. And unplanned. I was pretty unhappy about it. But I did have faith that I would come around, you know. And I think I did come around. And when he was 17 months old, I had three boys, I went back to work. I went to work full-time at the post office. Actually, full-time and overtime. And that's when my drinking really took off again, because I would drink with people after work. And we would go off at 2:30 in the morning and find the places, well, generally other people's apartments, to drink. And then I became involved with the man at work. Of course, my husband works at the post office. I work at the post office. The man I'm involved with works at the post office. So again, it was a little messy. And one night I stayed out all night drinking. I was the designated driver, and I had manipulated that my husband would stay home with the kids. And I would go drinking at the mine shaft. No, I wasn't going drinking. I was going dancing at the mine shaft with my male coworker, and not the one I was having an affair with, but he lived with the one I was having the affair with. And I got there, and I thought, and I drank an orange juice, and I like a drink of water, and I danced, and it was good. And then I told myself that lie: what harm will one beer do? And I had one beer. And then we went back to his apartment, and then I drank wine, finished off a half gallon of wine, and then I started drinking vodka. And if I had chosen a very, very, very strong screwdriver would be my last drink, I would not have chosen that, but that's what my last drink was. And I had to... Some things happened that night. They weren't horrible. It wasn't like the worst thing that happened in my life. It wasn't even the worst drunk I ever had. But I was, it was just time, you know. They called my husband, told him I couldn't drive home because I was so drunk. And when I came to early morning, I parked my car so in a way that I shouldn't have parked it, so someone had blocked my car in, and I drive it over this yard and back home, and my husband's waiting for me, and he said, I don't know what you're going to do, but you got to do something. And I thought, I wasn't honestly that concerned about the marriage, but I didn't want to lose my kids. I thought that I would lose my children. And so the kids were 4, 7, and 10. And the 4-year-old had a play date. And the 7 and 10-year-old were good buddies. I mean, they played well together. And so I took the youngest to his play date. And then I got down on my knees in my bedroom. And I just asked God for help. So everybody has a different story. So this is mine, is that I felt a real sense of peace. I also felt a sense that there was work to do, and that everything would be okay. That was my feeling. And I had a Bible. I've always been a spiritual seeker. There was a Bible, and I thought, I'll just do this thing, you know, where you just open up the book. And it opened up to the last proverb, which is the... I always think I should look this up before I tell my story. Yeah, but it's about the price of the good woman is whatever. And it's kind of a controversial proverb, but what it said to me that me as a woman, I could be a woman of dignity. That's what it said to me, and that's what I needed to hear. Now I haven't had a drink since then. A few days before that last drunk, I'd called a counselor because I thought I was going crazy. And I just felt like I was a shell of a human being. Like there was nothing. There was nothing. I mean, it's just like the skin, and then there was nothing. And I had this appointment with her, and I went to her, and I told her I was an alcoholic, even though I didn't believe it. It's a lot. That word was really, really weighted for me. And she got out a meeting list. You know, she left her office and she came back and she got this meeting list and she told me about Alcoholics Anonymous and did I need someone to take me to a meeting? And I said, no, I can do it. And we picked out St. Paul's meeting on Thursday night, 8 p.m. And I went there for my first meeting. And it was a big group then. It was a smoking, it was a non-smoking meeting, one of those curious hybrids where half the room is non-smoking and the other is smoking, like that works. And they were still the Mountainwood Treatment Center, so there were vans of people from Mountainwood that came in. And I felt extremely superior to all of you. And at the end of the meeting, when they gave out the chips, I didn't know what they were doing. But the man who led the meeting, God rest his soul, I remember him very well, he said, well, if anybody wants this white chip after the meeting, they just come and get it from me. And by that time, I'd sort of realized what the chips were about. And after the meeting, I went and I got a white chip from him. And this woman just gave me a big hug, and I felt very welcomed, and I felt hope. That's what I took away from that meeting. I took away that I never had to drink again. That's what they said. They said, you never have to drink again. And that sounded pretty good. And that it was the first drink that got me drunk. That's what I remember. First, and I was like, no, that doesn't make any sense, because I know it's not the first drink. You know, it's like the fifth or the sixth, and it's like I'm always trying to figure out which one got me drunk, and by the time I figured it out, I was drunk. You know, I was always trying to stop. But they said, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. Okay. So, and they told me, don't drink and go to meetings. And I needed it that simple at that time. And I went to, and then I heard at my second meeting, 90 meetings in 90 days, which was not possible for me. My husband and I, you know, the marriage wasn't in good shape. And even though when I was drinking, I would try to sneak in at night so we wouldn't have an argument, you know, like hopefully he's asleep and I can just get in, you know. And he fought my recovery. He didn't support me in going to AA. I don't think he knew how much I know today he didn't understand. He didn't realize how much I was drinking. And with the three young kids. But I went to as many meetings as I could. And sometimes I took the kids with me if there was a situation. The three of them, they could play together. You know, if there's a situation where that worked, I would take them. And I got a sponsor right away, and I got a home group right away. I've always had a home group. It's always been important to me. So Living Sober was my first home group. Then my first service job was making coffee. I'm a feminist. I had been trained as a secretary. And I said, I don't make coffee. Don't do that. So I never did it professionally. And I learned how to make coffee. I don't even drink coffee. That's the other thing. I don't like coffee. I've tried my hardest to like coffee, and I've never liked it. So I don't know why. It seems like it'd be one of those things, being the addictive personality I am, that I would like, but I didn't. And then I learned about the steps. For me, it's been very gradual. My first sponsor was the perfect, I think, sponsor for me at the time. We had been friends before. She'd gotten into recovery about a year ahead of me. And she had time that she could give me. And we talked every day. And she taught me about HALT. She taught me about daily readers. She taught me about fellowship and going to meetings. And then about a year, I said, I'd like to get started on these steps. And she said, you'll have to have somebody else help you with that, because she had not worked the steps. And so I got another sponsor. I was really frightened of the fourth step. I'd always had a belief in a higher power. You know that paragraph that shows people how we found our relationship with God, on page 29 there. I'd always had a relationship with a higher power. At the end of my drinking, I prayed every night. I prayed to my higher power whether I should go home to my husband and my children or if I should go out drinking. And my higher power said, you deserve the drink. So I clearly needed a different higher power. But I was open to it. I didn't resist. I was not turned off by the God references at all. So I turned my will and my life over to my higher power, step three. And then I started on the fourth step, and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I was hung up on the sexual inventory. I said, I cannot go through that. I cannot look at all those people. And I was frightened. So it was a long procrastination. And then I heard some were in a meeting, say to go back and do the step before. And I thought, well, I've done the third step. But I did it. I did it again. I did it. I'd heard in a meeting about this woman who had done it, actually at the church, Emmanuel Lutheran, with her, I don't know, her sister or somebody. And she had just gone into the sanctuary and got on her knees and said the third step prayer. And I thought, maybe I need something formal like that. So I had a spiritual teacher. I'd gotten back involved with Sufis, and I have a spiritual teacher. I met her at St. Paul's Church in the little chapel, and I got down on my knees, and I said the third step prayer. And she, and I felt a change. I felt fear lifted. And then it was a matter of about 2 weeks. I could write out my whole four step. To the best of my ability at the time. I'm 2.5 years not drinking at this point. So, and then my life, you know, they talk about, to me that was just there's a woman in Charlottesville who after every meeting, I really loved her, admired her sobriety, but after almost every meeting and after whatever I'd share, she'd like, do your four step, do your four step, do your four. I was like so sick of her saying, do your four step. And then after I'd done my fourth step, I was like, oh, I get it now. I mean, this is where the real change started to happen. It's when I had given all that old life, you know, looked at it all and looked at the patterns and all my resentments and that then I could be something different, and also the burden of the things that I had done that I really was ashamed of, those were exposed to the air. But there's always a positive inventory too. And so I got to see the things that I was doing well. And not everything that I'd done was shameful. You know, I had some really good shining moments despite everything. So, fourth step. And then, well, the fifth step. Fifth step I enjoyed doing with my sponsor. I left that feeling. You know, everybody's different. I can only share my experience is that I felt much better after I did my fifth step. I felt much better. And then we move on to the sixth step, which is, to me, it's right in the middle because they say in the 12 and 12, it divides the men from the boys, you know, the girls from the women, and it's about growing up, becoming ready to become an entirely different person. And It seems very small in the big book. You know, I think there's just a paragraph or two about it. But to me, it's like the pivot step. And then giving, asking God to remove my shortcomings. And, you know, the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to my higher power. So that means they haven't all been removed. Apparently, they're not standing in. Apparently, my anxiety isn't standing in the way of my usefulness to my higher power. Oh well, I can live with it. Yeah. The amends step took me a few years, but they've completed. I think maybe they took me about 3 years. Some people it took a little while to track down. God, this one guy I called and apologized for my part in this really sick relationship we had, and I just felt so low of myself that I thought everybody, I just didn't think people took me seriously, and so that when I told this guy that I loved him, he believed me, you know, but I didn't love him, but he thought I loved him, and when I went to make the amends, it seemed like he'd been waiting however many years for me to say I was sorry. It was really powerful because I just thought I didn't have that kind of effect on somebody's life. And he was really moved. Of course, then he wanted to stay in touch with me, and I said, no. No, but it was just like, I thought that maybe it was one of those amends I didn't need to make, and it turned out to be one of the amends I really needed to make. My sponsor helped me with my list. You know, I made the list, and then she honed it down. And I was very relieved when there were some. She said, no, you don't need to do that. And not so happy when she said, you need to do these. Financial ones were the easiest ones for me. I didn't have huge financial ones, but, I, you know, there's things that I had stolen and that. And I took care of those. So continue to take personal inventory. So we've moved up to the maintenance step. Sought through prayer and meditation, and then carrying the message. And that's where I live my life today in those last three. Although I rotate through the steps, I'm in the sort of the middle again. I just did a seventh step last week, and we'll be honing my eighth step again. But at this point, they're really living amends. But every once in a while, every few years, I get all gummed up, and it's like apparently my tenth step's not working because I'm not feeling great. And so I will go through the fourth and the fifth and, you know, the whole thing. Go through the whole thing again. So what it's like now. Something I never imagined would happen, is this is the most imminent thing, is that I'm going to be a grandmother. And my oldest son, who had a quite horrible relapse on alcohol last year, and he and his girlfriend, soon after he became sober again, she became pregnant. And they moved from Key West, Florida to near Stanardsville. So because of my children, my youngest child has some mental health issues, and my oldest child was not, I just didn't think I'd be a grandmother. That's it. And believe me, I inventoried it many, many, many times. My baby sister has 12 grandchildren, you know, and I'm 61, and I'm going to have my first grandchild. And that's the grace of God. So, and that middle son who was, I was clean and sober and really experienced that pregnancy and birth. When he was 14 years old, he was diagnosed with cancer. I was 7 years sober at the time. And my first thought, I tell this all the time. I mean, this proves that I'm an alcoholic. My first thought when he was diagnosed is, oh, good, I can drink now. It's like everybody will understand, you know. And then my second thought is, if I drink, I won't be there for him. So he lived for 19 months with cancer, and he passed away at the UVA hospital in October of 97. So our family, you know, I didn't drink. I didn't want to drink. That's the miracle of it. The book talks about it, you know. We won't even want to drink. We've had a psychic change. I have passing thoughts of drinking occasionally. I do want to share that when I was 15 years sober, I did have a long period, several weeks, when I did want to drink. And, you know, it was like, I want to kill myself or I want to drink, which is like the same thing. It's the same. And both those things are off the table for me. But I had lost my faith in a higher power. Just the accumulation of, like, my father's death, a wonderful woman in Charlottesville named Virginia. She passed away. And, you know, it had been about 5 years or so after my son had died. And I just, like, I had a difficult time with people telling me that my child was in a better place. And that God had, you know, and I said, I can't believe in that God. I can't believe in a God that would be so cruel to take away my child. Yeah. So I had to find another higher power, whom I still choose to call God, but it's just a different God. So I managed to get through that time of intensely wanting to drink on a daily basis, believing in group of drunks. I love that acronym, group of drunks. Everybody in this room that's staying sober is a power greater than me. Yeah. And also fake it till you make it. So I don't have to have a belief in a higher power. I can just pretend I have a belief in a higher power. And I pretended, and I pretended, and I still said my prayers. And I also, my sponsor was very, very close to me, kept me close. And I, what else? I just started the steps over. And I was thinking that maybe I really wasn't an alcoholic. See, that's a dangerous place. Maybe after all these years, after 15 years of not drinking, that I could drink safely. So I did what I hadn't done before, is I wrote out a first step. I wrote out, like, my first memory of drinking and every time I could remember drinking. And within, like, I couldn't even write out, like, 15 months of my drinking when I was like, I can never drink in safety. I don't have it. I am not a normal person. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I have a disease. When I put alcohol into my body, it just is not metabolized the way that my husband. It just says to my body, I want more. I want more. I want more. So I feel really grateful to have gotten through that period of intensely wanting to drink. I guess one other thing I would say is that I did do 90 and 90 later. And if you're new, I can't say enough about it. It plugged me into the program in a way that it was just wonderful doing 90 and 90. I just made the commitment to myself that I would do it. And what happened was that it was after that 90 and 90 that my son was diagnosed with cancer. And I was like, God, I had good, what I thought was really good sobriety at the time. And to think that first thought was, now I can drink, you know. So alcohol is a disease. It's not a sin. It's not a moral shortcoming. I'm just physically different from other people. And I'm always grateful that how I get better is these steps, you guys, helping others. It's a pretty, as diseases go, you know, it's a pretty nice one to recover from. So that's all. Thanks.